story about daylight saving time. Reminds me when Bob and I were flying into Moscow, we were flying with a group of journalists who had come from some sort of game in which the Soviets had played in Frankfurt, and they were on the same plane. And as we were landing, one of them said, "Well, we're getting to Moscow, it's time to turn back our clocks and our watches." And the guy next to him said in English, "Yes, 200 years." Our next contributor is Mikhail, or Michael, if you prefer the English, Bernstrom, who is the senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and who hails from the Soviet Union, graduate, got his PhD from the Academy of Sciences in the USSR. Incidentally, it's interesting that virtually all of the major figures in politics in the Soviet Union have some roots in the scientific community. And when I asked one of them why this was so, he said, "Well, we at least dealt with real things." He also received an AP in history from the Academy of Arts in Leningrad. More recently, he has become an advisor on economic reforms to the government of the Russian Republic. In fact, he's been the coordinator of the advisory relationship between Hoover and the Supreme Council of the Russian Parliament. I have a curriculum vitae here that is 9 pages long, and anyone who would provide a 9-page curriculum either should have the entire thing read, which would take up all of his time, and he would not be able to speak at all, or nothing at all should be read from it, and I will choose that course. That's right. Michael Bernstrom. Yes, I think this one has a long on board.
Thank you very much. And recently I followed implicit advice Professor Pipes has just given, that we should work with republics of the Soviet Union. And 3 months ago, for the first time in history of the relationship between the Soviet Union, or parts of the Soviet Union, and the United States, the government of the Russian Republic, or more specifically the Supreme Economic Council of the Russian Republic, which is roughly equivalent of the Council of Economic Advisors in this country. So this is the Supreme Economic Council, which advises Mr. Yeltsin on how to write and implement economic reform. And this organization invited an institutional group, a group of American economists, to write position papers, to go to Moscow, and to help them to make right decisions, to avoid mistakes, and to write an economic reform. And I'm a part of that effort, and I'm a coordinator of that effort. So it's the first institutional group working on economic reform with the Russian Republic. It is a great privilege to be here and to speak to you for the first time, perhaps for the last time. Very few organizations invite me to speak for the second time after being here, what I have to say. And I have a very sad record of several savings and loans institutions which invited me to speak to them for the last few years, and now they're nowhere to be found. And I hope that the Philadelphia Society will fare better than those organizations. How much time do I have, Paul?
10 minutes
is fine. Let me set up my timer here for 10 minutes. And when it beeps, then I will stop. And that's a useful device. And let me divide, you have to discipline yourself, right? Let me divide my presentation into two parts. And for the first 5 minutes then, I will speak on a very simple question. Why are we witnessing the collapse of the socialist economy? I think 5 minutes is more than enough for solving that problem. And the next 5 minutes, I will share with you some ideas that I am giving to the government of the Russian Republic, and what kind of an economic reform should be conducted, and what sort of mistakes especially mistakes of the sort made in Poland and Hungary and East Germany and other countries of Eastern Europe, what sort of mistakes should be avoided. Because the general idea is, of course, that successful economic reform must be successful, meaning that it is very easy to reduce the standard of living to create inflation and unemployment. Anyone can do that. But this cannot be, even in the short term, the purpose of the economic reform, although the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund can call the stabilization policy or whatever fancy words they would use. And of course, the purpose of the economic reform, from an economist's perspective, is plain and simple, to improve human well-being and to do it at the lowest cost possible, to minimize unemployment, to minimize transitionary costs, to minimize the decline in the standard of living, to minimize inflation, and to see to it so that week by week and month by month and year by year, the situation of the country is improved. I was deeply moved, I was an advisor to the Romanian government, and still am to an extent, and I was deeply moved by one conversation recently, a year ago, when we had a group of American economists, and one friend of mine said to them, listen, you just tell your people that for 3 years they have to suffer a lot. Things will get worse before they get better. But after that, they will have a tremendously bright future. Just they have to suffer for 3 years. And Mr. Slobodjan was, he was then finance minister, now he's deputy prime minister of Romania, I believe. He told us, no, we can't tell them that. We can't tell our people this story. Why? Because that was exactly what the Ceausescu government and the communists told them all the way for so many decades. We have to give them something. So this is the sole purpose, I think, of any responsible economic advisors, is to find the most efficient way for making an economic reform. Now, the way that is helpful rather than would hurt people, and the long-term consequences we still cannot predict. It is terribly irresponsible, and I should say, if I may use a strong word, immoral, to promise that our intellectual knowledge, based on our theories, would in 3 or 5 or 10 years yield great results, and what we ask now as human guinea pigs to suffer more after these decades of suffering. If I were given this kind of an advice, I would quit. I wouldn't do it. Now, let's turn for a moment, before we go into that, let's turn for a moment to the causes of the economic decline of the socialist economy, why this is not a viable system. A few months ago, Mr. Gorbachev, the president of the Soviet Union, introduced a theory, which I believe is correct, at his meeting last December with the directors of Soviet enterprises. Actually, this is the theory I was pushing for the last several years, but among intellectuals, we don't care who said this first, as for as long as it is correct. We have no vanity, right, among intellectuals. Let's say this is a Gorbachev theory. And he said that until the mid-80s, when the Soviet labor force was growing, the Soviet economy could develop, they had economic growth, and after the mid-80s, economic growth had stopped earlier in the late 70s, but the economy began to decline in the mid-80s when labor force stopped to grow. As you can see empirically, this is a correct assertion, because for the Soviet Union as a whole, the mid-80s was the time when the number of entrants in the labor force was slightly higher than the number of departures, and that was mostly due to the labor force increase in Central Asia and other underdeveloped regions. But in the Russian Republic, where over 60% of the Soviet GNP is produced, and where more than 75% of all natural resources are produced, the 80s, and especially the mid-80s, was a period of absolute decline until the mid-90s, absolute decline in the labor force. And therefore, it is true that there were pure objective, or sometimes economists say exogenous, reasons for the fact that the Soviet economy experienced tremendous shortages and a crisis. Why does this matter? Why should it matter? What is socialism? We have lots of definitions. Let me propose a simple technical one. The socialism is a system of monopolies, production monopolies, all production stages, from consumer goods, distribution and trade, to producer goods, to natural resources. In the United States, there are more than 4 million firms and companies producing goods and services, not counting self-employed small proprietors, tax-paying enterprises, and there will be more than 5.5 million. In the Soviet Union, there are 46,000 enterprises. There are 100 times more producer units in the United States, and this is a competitive market system in which producers compete and minimize costs. In the monopoly system, in which a small number of enterprises are producing goods and services, meaning that there are actually some 20,000 major enterprises in the Soviet Union, which produce some 80% of what is the Soviet economy. This means that the cost of production on every individual enterprise equal the prices at which these products are sold to the government. There is no competition. One enterprise produces a particular good or resource or commodity. And of course, this means that prices are based on costs, and the crucial point is profits are then proportional to costs. Once profits are proportional to costs, in order to maximize profits, enterprises maximize costs. And this is the true story of the socialist economy. And when Mr. Gorbachev came to power, 2 months or 3 months later after he came to power, he made a speech in which he formulated, I believe Professor Adam Began suggested that, that the Soviet economy is a cost-maximizing economy, or as we say in the United States, an input-maximizing economy. And this, of course, means that such an economy is not a viable system. One of the factors of production of one of the resources will or must be exhausted. If you look further and compare the Soviet economy and the United States economy, you will find that the Soviet economy uses about 80% as much energy in the United States, 60% more steel, produces only 77% as much technology, machinery, and equipment, uses 80% more fertilizers, 40% more pesticides, 180% more horsepower of tractors and combines, has only two-thirds of grain production. Much more inputs, much less output, imports grain, has as much grain inputs as the United States, produces about half as much meat if you trust official statistics, or much less than that if you don't. But eventually, total resource inputs in the Soviet economy are 20% higher than in the United States. And final human consumption in the mid-80s was 28%. Now, consumption per capita in the Soviet Union, after all this inflation, is officially estimated as one-fifth, 20% of the United States. So, more than 4.1 times ratio of inputs to outputs. This is indeed an input wasting, input maximizing economy. And when one of the resources or one of the factors of production begins to decline, the whole thing, okay, the whole thing is, I'll take one more minute. Let's say a human being needs air, food, water. Take one out. Life stops. So the economy needs labor, capital, natural resources. One of these factors goes, the economy collapses. That's what happened in the Soviet Union. Production, labor force declines, and now production of natural resources began to decline. Everything stopped. And unfortunately, I have to stop. And I didn't even have time to turn to the second question, which is the future of the Soviet Union. So it was not enough, more than 5 minutes I took, not enough time to discuss that. And perhaps in the question and answer session, we shall discuss what should be the strategies of a successful economic reform. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.